Great. Well, it's really good to be back with you. Thanks for your welcome. We're going to be looking at Nehemiah chapter 13. If you need to borrow a Bible, then I think there's some people standing by with some. So just indicate and one will come to you. It's on page 499, I think, of that version. You've got to tell me if it isn't. I think it is that we're reading. Nehemiah chapter 13. I gather this is the last, it must be because of the last chapter of Nehemiah, the last session that you're having together on the book of Nehemiah. And you probably don't need me to tell you what it's about, but in fact, perhaps we should have a quiz, but I won't do that. It's about how the Israelites returned back to Jerusalem from exile. They were in Babylon and places over that way. And as they came back to Jerusalem, they begin to build the walls of their city again. In fact, they complete their job. And it's not just the walls that get built. Other things are built as well. Their identity as God's people. Their kind of sense of who they are in God. Their place in God's purposes. And what kind of community they're meant to be, centered around God and around what he's done and around his truth. And Nehemiah is the key leader, really, who comes back from Babylon to get this job or to get this, lead the people in this process of rebuilding the walls of their city and also building their community up again, really. He's God's man for the job. But the whole story starts in prayer. He begins with prayer. He realizes what's going on. God puts it on his heart to do something. And as you tracked it through, you'd have seen his gifts that he had, the position that he had, the opportunities. Lots of things in Nehemiah's life all came together as he became the man that God wanted to lead his people in this way. And you see this kind of picture of this man's story. He's very honest, as you've noticed, we'll see this morning. He's very upfront about all the troubles that they have and the challenges and the difficulties. It's Nehemiah's book. It's called the Book of Nehemiah. Nehemiah's name is on it. And it's quite interesting. It's written in an autobiographical style. Have you noticed? He says, I did this and I did that. And as we'll see today, he says, I prayed this and I prayed that. And we're in the final part, as I said. Last week, as John was reminding you, in many ways, you reach the high point of Nehemiah in chapter 12. The walls are rebuilt, as we heard. The people process around the walls. There's praise about everything. And I was going to read verse 43 of chapter 12, and I will, because it's such a lovely verse. It sums up where they got to. On that day, they offered great sacrifices. That was the way they worshipped God in those days, rejoicing because God had given them great joy. The women and children also rejoiced. The sound of rejoicing in Jerusalem could be heard far away. Did you notice how many times that word joy comes in there? It was joyful. It was great. It was amazing. It was just that sense of God with them and their response to God in worship and praise and just fantastic. God had given them, it says, God had given them great joy. It wasn't just that the songs were good. It wasn't just that they were really pleased about having done their job. God had given it to them. And it's a lovely picture. And chapter 12 ends, as you probably saw last week, with another picture of the temple working really well. It's being resourced from tithes. The temple has been built, the walls have been built, the city, and now the community is working brilliantly. They had all these Levites and singers and other people who did like shifts to serve in the temple, either as priests or as other things. And those people they settled in villages, but they gave time to serve God in that way, provided for by all the tithes and the offerings that the people of Israel gave. That was all really, really working brilliantly, as you must have seen. So it's a kind of renewal of worship in the community. It's just a great, great picture. And it carries on into chapter 13. Look at what chapter 13, let's read verses 1 to 3. On that day, the book of Moses was read aloud in the hearing of the people. And there it was found written that no Ammonite or Moabite should ever be admitted into the assembly of God, because they had not met the Israelites with food and water, but had hired Balaam to call a curse down on them. Our God, however, turned the curse into a blessing. When the people heard this law, they excluded from Israel all who were of foreign descent. Now here they're responsive to God's word. We've seen that before in Nehemiah. They've read the law of God and they thought, oh, we haven't done that. We'd better get on with it and do something about it. And this particular rule, or this law they had, was that actually within the closed community of Israel, the core community, they shouldn't have people from the other races like the Ammonites. And there was a historical reason for that. Obviously, that didn't mean they excluded those people completely. You know, the book of Ruth? You know the book of Ruth? Ruth was a Moabite. And Ruth was welcomed into the community of Israel because she trusted God. It wasn't that, you know, they weren't allowed in because they were Ammonites or they were Moabites. It wasn't a racist thing. It was an issue of being part of the worshipping community of God. And the people who worshipped other gods from the nations around, they were welcome in to worship the God of Israel, but they weren't kind of welcome to take a core place in the community if they weren't within that worshipping community. And the people respond to that. And again, it's all really good, isn't it? But actually, it doesn't end there. Oh, if only the book of Nehemiah ended there. Wouldn't that be good? Let's read on, verse 4 to 5. Before this, Eliashib, the priest, had been put in charge of the storerooms of the house of our God. He was closely associated. That means he was kind of connected by possibly family relationship in some way with Tobiah. And he had provided him with a large room formerly used to store the grain offerings and incense and temple articles, and also the tithes of grain, new wine and oil prescribed for the Levites, singers and gatekeepers, as well as the contributions for the priests. Tobiah is an Ammonite. Do you remember him? Anyone remember who Tobiah is? He appears in the story in the beginning as one of the enemies, one of the opponents. He and another guy called Sanballat, who interestingly pops up at the end of this chapter as well, and an Arab called Gershom were like the opposition to the building. And they were opposed to what God's people were doing. They mocked them, they tried to stop them, they tried to, pardon me, threaten Nehemiah, trick him, all kinds of things. They were like the bad guys, the opposition really. And now, this man is in the temple. He's an Ammonite, but he doesn't get removed along with the others, in response to God's word. No, there's an exception here. He's too deep in with the high priest. And he's got a huge area in the temple, probably. We're not talking, you know, like, you know, the little office up there, probably, where I used to work sometimes. It was a cute, cozy little place. Now, we're talking about something big enough to store all the grain and the tithes and the offerings and the oil and the wine. It must have been like a small warehouse area. Quite what he was doing there, we don't know, but there he was in the middle of the temple, kind of settling down, kind of leader previously of the opposition, right in there with the people of God. That's him, that's Tobiah. And you know, I think this gets us into what this passage today is about. This story doesn't end on the high point of chapter 12, because it shows us something really important. It shows us that spiritual growth, life with God, progress in the kingdom has to be sustained, has to be kept going. Some of you are scientific types, I'm not one, to know about the second law of thermodynamics. That means basically that everything kind of tends towards, it kind of runs down, basically. In other words, if you put a car in a field, in the corner of a field, this is another application, it's not strictly thermodynamics, as you know. See, I don't really know anything about it. I'm an arts person. You leave it there, and you leave it for a year and year and year and year. What happens to it? Come back in 10 years' time, it's rusty, it's grown over, it's kind of deteriorating. Without input, if you do nothing, it reverts back to a wild state. And in some ways, I think it's like this in the kingdom of God. It's like this in spiritual progress. It's like that in our lives. And we see in this part of Nehemiah that all the work Nehemiah has done, all the great progress they made, begins to unravel. It just begins to kind of slip. So Nehemiah comes back to put in a bit more work, as we shall see. Now, what about us? What about me? What about you? It's true in our spiritual lives, isn't it? Because the world is fallen. We are fallen people. There's a spiritual battle going on. if we do nothing, if we just drift, we will move backwards. Individually, in our spiritual lives, as a community, there is that. That's what happened to the Israelites. Have we got that? Do we realize that that's a danger? Now, what this passage really is about is how Nehemiah gets them back on track again. Because that's the good news. We can always get back on track. And let's read verse 6 to 14. See, while all this was going on, says Nehemiah, he's writing in the first person now, I was not in Jerusalem, for in the 32nd year of Artaxerxes, king of Babylon, I had returned to the king. Sometime later, I asked his permission and came back to Jerusalem. Now, all this has been kind of drifting while Nehemiah's been away, and he comes back. And here he says in verse 7, I learned about the evil thing Eliashib had done in providing Tobiah a room in the courts of the house of God. I was greatly displeased and threw all Tobiah's household goods out of the room. I gave orders to purify the rooms, and then I put back into them the equipment of the house of God with the grain offerings and the incense. I also learned that the portions assigned to the Levites had not been given to them, and that all the Levites and singers responsible for the service, all those people that we read about in chapter 12, what had happened to them, they'd gone back to their own fields. So I rebuked the officials and asked them, why is the house of God neglected? And I called them together and stationed them at their posts. All Judah brought the tithes of grain, new wine and oil into the storerooms. I put Shelemiah the priest, Zadok the scribe, and a Levite named Pedaiah in charge of the storerooms, and made Hanan, son of Zakur, son of Mattaniah, their assistant. Because these men were considered trustworthy, they were made responsible for distributing the supplies to their brothers. So what was the problem then? Nehemiah comes back and uncovers the problem and begins to deal with it. What was it? Well, Eliashib, the priest, had made an exception of Tobiah, as we said. He's allowed him to base himself in the temple, although he's a proven enemy, and it was against what God had said in his word. So he's disobeying the word, isn't he? Eliashib is. Not necessarily actively, but it was just, you know, Tobiah was like his mate. Tobiah had married one of his relatives. You know, it was just, it's so difficult to get Tobiah out, perhaps. So he kind of turns a blind eye and just carries on. And so thinks, we'll just carry on. But Nehemiah comes back. What does Nehemiah say about it? Well, Nehemiah tells the nobles that it's evil. Actually, what Eliashib was doing was not just kind of a comfortable life. It was not just a blind eye. It was actually he was going against God. And good was not going to come out of it. Actually, evil would come from it. It's quite kind of a challenging thing, isn't it? So what does Nehemiah do when he takes radical action? Nehemiah, you know, he's quite a character, isn't he? You know, whether he did it himself, but he goes there and he storms it and he chucks Tobiah out of his room. He gets other people and he purifies the room. He takes some very significant action. I suppose, in a way, he's helping Eliashib to do the right thing. You know, Eliashib was so kind of tied up. Nehemiah comes alongside and says, look, if you can't do it, Eliashib, I will. And then perhaps there's a lesson for us. Sometimes we need other people to help us to do the right thing, maybe. But more than that, what's the problem? That's the question. What is the problem here? Well, verses 10 and 11 tell us that all the temple workers are gone. All those people who were able to come in and lead the worship and do the music and all the stuff in the temple, supplied by or resourced by the gifts and offerings, they couldn't come anymore because all the gifts and offerings had dried up. What's that? Is that just about logistics? It's interesting that Tobiah, what was the room that Tobiah was in? What was it used for before? It was used for storing tithes and offerings. Interesting that, you know, when Eliashib kind of gave Tobiah a house room, perhaps he didn't think that actually his kind of compromise in that area was going to displace something much more important down the line, which is what happens. Because when Nehemiah comes along, what does he say to them? He says to the nobles in verse 11, why is the house of God neglected? They had neglected the house of God. That was what was going on. That was the problem. Now, do you remember what they said a few chapters earlier in chapter 10? verse 39. Remember the Israel, there was a great renewal, and they responded to the Lord, and they came back to the Lord, and they responded to the word, and they made a covenant, promises to God, in verse 39. They said, this is what they agreed to do. The people of Israel, including the Levites, are to bring their contributions of grain, new wine, and oil to the storerooms where the articles for the sanctuary are kept, and where the ministering priests, the gatekeepers, and the singers stay. Quote, they said, we will not neglect the house of our God. That was the promise they had made. We won't neglect the house of our God. The promise they made now has been broken. And Nehemiah helps them to see that. He said, look, this isn't just about Tobiah in the house. This isn't just about, you know, not having gatekeepers and singers. This is about a promise you made, which you've gone back on to God. What's the problem? Their priorities are going out of line, aren't they? That's the problem. See, the focus of the book of Ezra and Nehemiah is all about priorities. It's not just to be about them living back in the land comfortably. If you read the book of Ezra, it's about the altar. It's about the temple. It's about the walls. It's about the word. It's about their living as a community with God and his truth at the very heart of their life together. That's what these books are about. Priorities, about what matters most. They were to be there. They were to be a community centered on God's covenant, God's love for them, God's rescue of them, God's kind of making them his own people and just saying, you're my people and I want you to live in the way I want you to. That was what they were meant to be. And that's what's getting lost. Their problems are being reordered. Their priorities are slipping. And Nehemiah helps them to see that, the priorities slipping. What about us? Can we get like that? The promise we made, our intention to live with God at the center of our lives, those priorities. I said earlier, it's great to baptize people. Great joy of being doing what I don't know. Other people usually get in the water. I'm a bit averse to water. I do other things, but sometimes I'm in the water. But anyway, as we take people through baptism, we've seen, you know, half dozen or more this year be baptized, and they also, and we ask the questions, maybe you do here, do you promise to follow Jesus for the rest of your life as your Lord and your Master? And they say, yes, I do. Like these people said, yes, we won't neglect the house of the Lord our God. We will live our lives with God at the center of them. And already it was beginning to slip. Can that happen to us? Well, think about that. I need to think about that. Because if we do nothing, we kind of drift back, don't we? Nehemiah takes leadership. There's a lot about leadership in Nehemiah. And he helps them to see what's wrong. He uses his influence to get the ties flowing again. It's fascinating to see how he deals with the problem. He recruits a leadership team, actually, to deal with the problem of supplying the temple staff and to keep it all going. It's a really wise way forward. You see, Eliashib was just one on his own. He got connected with Tobiah, and he was powerless to deal with the issue. He was accountable to nobody. So Nehemiah, in this phase of the work, as it were, he says, "Well, look, let's you know, whether what happened to Eliashib, we don't know. I suspect he still remained high priest." But Nehemiah gets these three, four different guys, different gifts, different backgrounds, different kind of skills to together take responsibility for this issue. Very wise, isn't it? And those guys are accountable to Nehemiah and to one another. It's a wise way forward. But this problem of priorities slipping is not just to do with the temple. There's much more to it than that. It was worked out in the whole of their community. It kind of touched how they did their jobs, how they lived their lives. There were areas where honouring God, they were meant to be different. And those places where they were meant to honour God and have God at the centre of their lives and where they were meant to be different didn't matter anymore. And those two areas we're going to read about now. One was for the Israelites about keeping the Sabbath. And the other one was to do with their family lives. So let's read on what it said. Well, verse 14 first. Remember me for this, O my God, and do not blot out what I have so faithfully done for the house of my God and its services. We have these little prayers in Nehemiah. I'm going to come back to that in a minute. Verse 15, in those days I saw men in Judah treading wine presses on the Sabbath and bringing in grain and loading it on donkeys together with wine, grapes, figs and all other kinds of loads. And they were bringing all this into Jerusalem on the Sabbath. Therefore I warned them against selling food on that day. Men from Tyre who lived in Jerusalem were bringing in fish and all kinds of merchandise and selling them in Jerusalem on the Sabbath to the people of Judah. I rebuked the nobles of Judah and said to them, what is this wicked thing you are doing, desecrating the Sabbath day? Didn't your forefathers do the same thing so that our God brought all this calamity upon us and upon this city? Now you're stirring up more wrath against Israel by desecrating the Sabbath. And when evening shadows fell on the gates of Jerusalem before the Sabbath, I ordered the doors to be shut and not opened until the Sabbath was over. I stationed some of my own men at the gate so that no load could be brought in on the Sabbath day. Once or twice the merchants and sellers of all kinds of goods spent the night outside Jerusalem. But I warned them and said, why do you spend the night by the wall? If you do this again, I will lay hands on you. From that time on, they no longer came on the Sabbath. It's like the French, isn't it, kind of action. Then I commanded the Levites to purify themselves and go and guard the gates in order to keep the Sabbath day holy. Remember me for this also, O my God, and show mercy to me according to your great love. Verse 23, moreover, in those days, I saw men of Judah who had married women from Ashdod, Ammon, and Moab. Half of their children spoke the language of Ashdod or the language of one of the other peoples and did not know how to speak the language of Judah. I rebuked them and called curses down on them. I beat some of the men and pulled out their hair. It's very, you know, quite a... I guess this is a symbolic action. This isn't the way we behave these days, let me say. Jesus taught us a better way. I made them take an oath in God's name and said, you're not to give your daughters in marriage to their sons, nor are you to take their daughters in marriage for your sons or for yourself. Was it not because of marriages like these that Solomon, king of Israel, sinned? Among the many nations there was no king like him, for he was loved by his God, and God made him king over all Israel. But even he was led into sin by foreign women. Must we hear now that you are doing all this terrible wickedness and being unfaithful to our God by marrying foreign women? One of the sons of Joiada, son of Eliashib, the high priest, was son-in-law to Sanballat, the Horonite. He's the other kind of bad guy. And I drove him away from me. Remember them, O my God, because they defiled the priestly office and the covenant of the priesthood and of the Levites. So I purify the priests and the Levites of everything foreign, and I assign them duties, each to his own task. I also made provision for contributions of wood at designated times and for the first fruits. Remember me with favor, O my God. Now, we don't have time to go into all of this, so just some headlines. As I said, their priorities, God at the center of their community, was meant to mean that they were different. And the Sabbath and how they treated the Sabbath, the seventh day in the Jewish kind of system, meant to be a mark of how different they were at that time. And they let that go. It starts to slip. And it leads to, they end up kind of blending in with all the people around them. That's the point. So that's a reference to men from Tyre, you know, are selling fish. It's a fascinating detail. But the issue, the point is that there's this kind of mixing going on. And Nehemiah tackles it. How does he do it? He makes it clear that it's the leader's responsibility, he says. He rebukes them. He has some very strong language. And then he helps them to see why it's a bad idea to break this law. He doesn't just kind of take action. He explains it to them. He tells them, look, think back to what's happened to Israel and why you got exiled in the first place. It was because you started disregarding God's law and because you weren't willing to live with God at the center of your community anymore. You just thought it didn't matter. And here you are now, and this symbolic use of the Sabbath was a clear example, again, of it beginning to slip. He actually teaches them. He helps them to see that actually, you know, it's not just about what they do on the Sabbath. It's part of their whole identity as God's people. Now, you know, we're in a different place. We don't have to keep the Sabbath. We're not living under that kind of regulation. The New Testament makes that very clear. So the application of this is not to say that, well, we shouldn't work on the Sabbath or whatever. Well, how you use Sundays is up to you entirely. We have freedom to do that. But I wanted to point here to there's a principle behind this. And the principle was that for these guys, keeping the Sabbath was a way of honoring God. It was showing that God was in their lives and to make a difference. That's the point. And all of that was slipping. The difference, the distinctiveness was going. So he, just as he did with Eliashib, Nehemiah comes along and helps them take action. He locks the city up, so nobody can come in and sell stuff on Friday night, isn't it? Yeah, Friday night, he shuts the gates. Nobody can come in on Saturday to do their business on the Sabbath. They have to wait outside till the following day. And then he gets accountable Levites. Again, he does the same thing. He gets other leaders in who are going to take care of that and ensure that's how it's going to be in the future. Again, there's a lot we can learn about how Nehemiah does leadership, but that's not really what this series is about. If you're interested, John White wrote a book called Excellence in Leadership, which is a study of Nehemiah as a leader, and it's really very interesting. So that was one where their priorities were slipping, and they were saying, well, look, how we do our jobs, how we trade, how we live our lives was just no different from anyone else. Their commitment to God was meant to make a difference in the whole of their lives. Hey, is that true for us? Yes, it is. And it may not be about Sabbath. It may be about some other area. But we need to be careful that our priorities to live our lives centered on Jesus don't begin to slip in the way we do our work, the way we live our lives. What goes on out of here, what happens, because most of us aren't here for most of the week, are we? We're just here for an hour on Sunday. It's easy to live for God for an hour on Sunday, well, relatively. But what about the rest of our lives? And then we see as well, it was meant to be seen, their priority for God at the center of their lives was meant to be seen in their lives as families. Now again, in the Jewish kind of law, in the Old Testament, it was really key that the Israelites were not to marry right out of their race. Not because of race, but because of their loyalty to God. Again, Ruth is an example of someone who came from a Moabite race, but came to know and love and trust God and married into Israel. It wasn't a racial thing. It was about their commitment to God. It needed to be common. And it was a problem in Ezra. And in Ezra's time, he took some very radical action. And you can read about it in the book of Ezra. And it was a really, Ezra, in the book of Ezra, they were so challenged by it, he encouraged them to put away their foreign wives. Well, Nehemiah does not do that. Maybe he's learned from what happened before. Nehemiah helps them to see why it matters. Again, he points to their identity as God's people. He tells them the story of Solomon. He helps them to see that there's a spiritual reason why you need to preserve unity in godly marriages. And they see the bigger picture. And so he encourages them to say, okay, just as the New Testament says, if you're married to an unbeliever, then you stay married to them. But he's saying to them, look, guys, in the future, if you marry again or your sons and your daughters, encourage them to marry within the faith of Israel. That's what he's saying to them. Because their identity as God's people really matters there. Now how we apply that is up for conversation, discussion. But the key thing is it's this priority here. Their priority to have God at the center of their lives is meant to be seen in their families and in their work. And that's so for us, isn't it? And we need to ensure that these priorities, the promises we made at our baptism or last time we had a fresh touch of the Lord, that we go back to them and we pick them up again and we are sustained in that. Priorities matter then. We need to be sustained in our following Jesus. We need to be aware of the danger of losing our priority to end up living. We need to watch out that we don't end up living as if our faith doesn't make any difference to the way we do our jobs or the way we live in our families. How would Nehemiah encourage us? Well, he'd tell us to remember why these priorities matter, as he did the people then. He'd tell us to remember the promises that we've made, not to neglect the Lord. He'd encourage us to keep the bigger picture, why we're believers at all, what it means that Jesus is Lord of our lives, how we're meant to be different to all the people around. He'd encourage us, secondly, to be accountable, especially in leadership. to not leave it all to one person, to help one another, to not compromise or to live for God. He'd encourage us to do that, just as he did then. He'd encourage us to deal with compromises, not to give house room, as it were, in our heads, in our hearts, in our lives, to stuff that's wrong, but to stuff that makes it hard for us to be obedient followers of Jesus. You see, in one sense, there was nothing wrong with having Tobiah giving him a big room in the temple, was there? Well, it didn't seem like it. But the fact that he was there meant that, you know, it was easier for them to stop bringing the tithes and offerings in. And sometimes stuff can come into our lives and we think, oh, it's, you know, it's a bit of a grey area or whatever. But actually, it can lead on to getting in the way of what God would want to do in our lives. And in Nehemiah would encourage us to take practical action. I guess I must stop. Priorities are important. What matters most? Is it reflected in our business, our lives, how we do stuff day by day in the family? Not the temple or the law for us, but the priority of God at the centre of our lives. We talk about sustainable development, don't we, in terms of international stuff. Well, how about sustainable spiritual development in your life and mine? Can I take another 3 minutes or less? Are we all right for time? I forgot what time I started now anyway. But anyway, because I want us to finally look at Nehemiah as a person, because I guess you've seen Nehemiah over these weeks, and I don't know what you think of him. As I said, it's his story. You know, the last lap in a race is pretty crucial, isn't it? I was once, when I was in school, had to run a race. It was a 440 yards, so it was about 400 metres. And it was in the race, and I did all right at that. I came third, actually, out of four. And anyway, it was only four of us, one for each of our houses. We had houses in our school. And I ran this race, and it was all right. And what happened then was, it was the mile coming up, and the guy running in our house, I think he was a guy called Nigel, he couldn't run for some reason. I don't know what he did. And I was sitting there in my singlet. It was a very hot day. And some people said, well, you were ready. Why don't you run it, John? And I thought, no. And then kind of people said, yeah, go on, you do it. And then I think there were a few parents joined in. And you know, anyway, I ended up on the starting line for the mile, four laps of 440 yards. And that was like four times around our square, the kind of running track, you know, in the school kind of field that was kind of marked out in the summer. Well, I started off and, you know, I ran it round. And I saw the finishing line, and I just kind of couldn't go on anymore. And I kind of collapsed and ended up in bed with heat stroke and something for the next kind of 4 days. And I didn't, and by the way, it wasn't the finishing line. It was only after the third lap, you see. I ran three laps. And pity, the last lap really matters, doesn't it? Now, Nehemiah, this is towards the end of his life. He's in the last lap. He keeps running. What does it look like? He's focused. He's courageous. He's wise. He's practical. I love his practicality. He's appropriate. You know, he's very, you know, the way he deals with this intermarriage thing is much more restrained than Ezra, who told them all, you know, a few years earlier when it came up to go and divorce their wives. So he was much more kind of restrained. And yet he's still resisting the old enemies. You know, Tobiah and Sanballat, they were giving him trouble in chapter 2, and he's still resisting them in chapter 13. And the same number of years, he was 12 years in Jerusalem as leader, and then he goes back to Babylon. We don't know for how many years, and now he's back in Jerusalem again. And he was already a mature, you know, he's at the top of his profession when he goes from Babylon back to Jerusalem. He's a top civil servant, you know. As you probably heard, you know, wine taster to the king was not any old job. It was a very top job that he had. So he's in his last lap. Now, how does he do it? How does he sustain? How is he sustained himself? Well, the prayers in this chapter give an answer. There's a prayer in verse 14, verse 22, verse 29, verse 31. And if you look at them, first of all, that he prayed at all. He has this relationship with God that is intact and vital right throughout his whole life. And so he finishes the race. Look at the nature of that relationship. It's very open. You know, it's embarrassingly open. You read some of Nehemiah's prayers in Nehemiah, and you think, oh, you know, they're not very, you know, they're not very kind of spiritual prayers. No, he lets God see how he's hurting and how he doesn't, you know, and so on and so forth. He's very open in that relationship. Look, thirdly, at the priorities in his own life. He wants to call people back to priorities. What are his priorities? You see it in those prayers. He keeps saying, remember me, Lord, remember me. Now, what's all that about? Is God going to forget him? No, it's not about that. What he's saying is that, God, as I pray to you, the key thing about my life is that it's before you. It's that you see it. The only thing that matters to me is not whether I do a good job, really, or not because of that, but how you see it, God. Just remember me. Just God, I want you to be kind of part of it, in it, with me. That's what matters most. He realizes that the work he's done is very fragile, as it is. It might fall apart at any moment. And he wants to make sure it isn't. But the main thing is not that. The main thing is this relationship with God. He knows, fourthly, he needs God's grace. Verse 22, he says, show mercy to me according to your great love. Great love, loving kindness, steadfast love, mercy. That's the Old Testament word for God's faithful covenant love. He knows he needs God's grace. He knows he needs to be forgiven constantly. He knows he needs to live in the light of God and his truth and his love and his goodness and the cross. He didn't know about the cross at the time, but you know, for us it's the cross. He knew that. And finally, and I love this, verse 29, he knows that he can leave the judging of other people to God. See that? He talks about the priests. He says, remember them, oh my God, because they did such and such a thing. He says, I'm going to leave that with you, God. That's your problem to deal with them. So I just think that that's quite an interesting little angle. You read these prayers when you get home as a window in how this man kept going in the last lap of his life as well as the rest of it. And I pray that we, those of us who may be, well, the thing is, none of us know when the last lap is, do we? You know, I've done funerals this year, and I did a funeral of someone who was 102. And some people, you know, die quite a lot younger than 102. We don't know. So in a sense, we need that sense of running with God to the finish, whenever it comes. Let's keep going until the end of the race. Let's keep the priorities right, whether it's together as a community or individually like Nehemiah, because whatever, both ways, it needs to be sustained for God's glory.